BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is Professor Dame Elizabeth Naka Anionwu. An Emeritus Professor of Nursing and Fellow of the Royal College of Nursing, she spent 40 years in the profession and has been named one of the most influential nurses in the history of the NHS. Her career was distinguished by her pioneering work in the understanding of sickle cell disease, bringing better treatment and support to the thousands living with it. She was the first sickle cell specialist nurse in the UK. Her decades of dedication, care and service are a contrast to her own disrupted and difficult childhood as a mixed-race child born out of wedlock in the 1940s, though it was the kindness of a nurse when she was just 5 that sparked a nascent interest in what would become her life's work. She left her day job behind in 2007, but as she puts it, it has not turned out to be a quiet retirement. As well as receiving her damehood, she spent 9 years fundraising and campaigning for a statue to British Jamaican nurse Mary Seacole. Unveiled in 2016 in the grounds of St Thomas's Hospital, the statue is the first representing a named black woman in the UK. She says, "Despite its rocky start, my life has been extremely fulfilling. Most importantly, it has been a vindication of all that my mother had to endure." Elizabeth Anionwu, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much, Lauren.
Thank you for being here. Now, like many who will be listening today, you're self-isolating because of your asthma. How have you been getting on?
I've actually got used to it now. Initially, the first few days were quite scary, I have to be honest. But I've got into a sort of pattern, and I've got a balcony and there are communal gardens that virtually nobody uses, which I'm delighted at, so that I can do an hour's walk out there and listen to my music.
And, yes, we're going to get to that.
And friends and relatives, they're all in contact. I have a 12-year-old granddaughter who is FaceTiming like nothing on earth. And I think it has helped me avoid sinking into any sort of depression with what is going on. Human contact is really valued now.
I wonder what you've made of the Thursday night clap for carers.
I think it's showing people solidarity, but I have to say I do agree with people that we hope that NHS staff are really being valued now and they need to continue with that in more ways than one, shall I say.
Speaking of NHS staff, obviously we know that among the NHS staff who've tragically lost their lives during the pandemic, a disproportionate number, perhaps as many as 60%, have been of black and minority ethnic heritage. Now, we know the NHS are planning to tackle this, but as someone who's spent their whole professional life in healthcare, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, all the deaths due to the COVID-19 pandemic here in the UK are absolutely tragic. But as a black nurse, I am so scared for my colleagues.
What would you like to see happen? What needs to change?
All staff in the NHS need to be listened to. But there's been a history of black and minority ethnic health professionals not really being valued as much as they should be. And for so many to have given their lives to this, and close to me are so many colleagues from black and minority ethnic backgrounds, and I just want them to be listened to and paid more and valued as all NHS staff should be.
We're going to come back to your experiences working in the health service later, of course, but for now we're going to turn to your list of tracks. Let's hear the first disc, Elizabeth. What's it going to be and why have you chosen this one?
It's Amy Wudge singing Faith's Song, and I see it as my love song to NHS professionals. It's very poignant, and I think if people listen to the words, they will understand the relevance at this critical moment in our country.
Give you all that you needed. You cut, but I'm bleeding. And all of my strength I give to you. I love completely. You lose, then you leave me. And all of my hope left.
Amy Wadge with Faith's Song. Elizabeth Anion Wu, let's go back a bit. You were born in 1947. Your mother was a promising student who had won a scholarship to Cambridge. And it was there that she met your father. He was a fellow student from Nigeria. What happened?
Well, I happened, Lauren. I was the outcome of their short affair. And it was a huge shock for my mother. She came from a deeply religious Catholic family. And it was my maternal grandmother that realised that she was pregnant during a trip back home to Stafford. And all my mother would say was that the father of the baby was a fellow student. Nothing else. And so when my grandparents came to visit my mother and me at the mother and baby home run by the Irish nuns, before they let them into the room, the nun turned round to them and said, "Ah, to be sure, the baby's a little dark." So this was obviously the first realisation that the father of the baby wasn't white as they would have assumed. Mm. So I can only imagine the waves of shocks that everybody went through, including obviously my mother.
What's your sense of what she would have been facing?
I think the first thing would be absolute shame and stigma and letting people down, because there must have been such joy when she got that scholarship. She was the first one to go to university and to go to such a prestigious university and study classics, you know, and she was doing brilliantly, apparently, at the university. So it's my mother I often think of, what the fear that she must have had in revealing the news. But she chose not go back to university. And many years later, she told me it was because she didn't feel that she could have the academic career that she wanted as a single mother.
She didn't want to give you up. She decided it was best for you to be brought up by the nuns, but was determined that you weren't to be adopted. To what extent were you aware of that, the idea that she intended to come back for you?
I always grew up knowing that my mother wanted to make a home for me. I don't remember when she first articulated that to me, but I never, ever had any sense of rejection from my mother. Even though I spent 9 years in the children's home, she visited me regularly. So I never had a sense of rejection. And I know that that's helped me enormously through my life.
Mm. It's time to go to the music. Your second disc today, Elizabeth, what's it going to be?
It's The Rakes of Mallow, good old Irish dance tune. And I did Irish dancing in the children's home up until the age of 9. I absolutely adored Irish dancing.
Were you any good?
I wasn't bad at all, Lauren. I used to get medals and dressing up. You know, we had our green outfit and lovely buckle shoes. We did tap dancing. Yes, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Glass, Kayleigh Band with The Rakes of Mallow. So Elizabeth Anion Wu, tell me a little bit more about your experience of growing up in care as a little girl. You were moved from the first care home you lived in when you were only 3, I think. What do you remember about the little girl that you were then?
I think I had my sense of humour from an early age. I seemed to get on well with people, but I also could get quite annoyed at what I would see as injustices and poor care. I mean, overall, I was happy, But there were some incidents which are still seared in my brain, I have to be honest. One was because I was a bedwetter. They would drape over the urine-soaked sheets over our bodies, and we'd have to put our arms up under the sheet. And the punishment was that we had to keep our arms stretched out. Well, of course, you can't do that for very long. And if your arm dropped, there was a nun on the other side of the sheet with a ruler or something and just whack you. I just thought, that is so cruel. And there were just a few that were pretty tough characters. Others were much kinder. I was taught to play the piano, just a few of us. And if we'd done our exercises okay, we'd be taken into Birmingham City Centre and have Knickerbocker glories. And you can imagine a few little kids sitting on these high stools, digging down for the last drop. You know, I've got wonderful memories of that, for example, yes.
And what about the other kids that you were living with? Were there many other children of colour at the home?
Not until I was 8. For most of my time, I was the only child of colour. And, for example, I washed my face 10 times in what would have been red Lifebuoy soap. What was that about? That was obviously to be like my friends. So there must have been incidents that made me feel that I was different, I was other, and I wanted to be like my friends.
I mentioned at the beginning of the programme that it was the kindness of one of the sisters that put you on the track to where you are now. What happened and how young were you?
She was the most wonderful nun. She used to run the sick bay, and I had very bad eczema. And so I'd go for daily dressings, coal tar paste. It'd be very cool, lovely, bandage goes on. But then when I had to go back for the dressing, I would actually peep round the door to see whether it was the nun with the white habit that was there. Because the nun with the black habit, she would just tear off the bandage and it would hurt and I would cry. But if it was the nun with the white habit, she would use distraction therapy. And she would use words like bottom. Well, you know, as a child, particularly brought up in a strict religious environment, I thought the word bottom was so rude. And I would burst out laughing. Of course, while I laughed, she would take the bandage off. I would not feel a thing. I just thought she was the most wonderful person on earth. Later on, before I left the convent, I realised she was something called a nurse. And I decided that's what I want to be.
Well, we'll hear more about how you got there in a moment. For now, it's time for your next disc today. What are we going to hear?
It's called Maman by Layla McCullough, who is a Haitian-American singer, beautiful voice. And, of course, Maman is mother in French. And this is an homage to my wonderful mother.
Maman chérie, c'est où toute vie, détermination. Juste entre sa affection manquée, tout ça cause des situations. Garde l'ange, garde manger, c'est que nous tous des caprochés, maman. Contente des mois de mes rivets, maman, pas gain, jour sacré.
Layla McCullough with Maman. Elizabeth Annie Onwu, your mother used to come and visit you at the children's home. What kind of things did you do together in the time you were able to have together?
She would always take me out, come rain or shine, and we would go to the Licky Hills, which was just up the road from where the convent was. Wonderful park where I had fantastic memories of rolling down the hill. She would take me for ice cream. It would be every month or so until I left at 9. It was a significant and important part of my life then.
When you were 9, your mother married a man called Ken and 3 years later moved to a council house in Wolverhampton with their young sons, and she decided it was time for you to leave care and come and live with her. Such an important moment for you. How did you get on in your new home?
When I arrived at my new home in Wolverhampton, I was actually a bit disappointed because I read a lot as a child, and I the images of a home, there was always a fireplace and photographs hanging from the wall, and there were no photographs hanging from the wall. It didn't look like the image that I'd hoped for. On the other hand, I was welcomed by my mother and my stepfather. Initially it worked out, but I only stayed there for 20 months because gradually there was a change in the relationship between myself and my stepfather. I later learned he was being teased by his mates in the pub about having, again, half-caste child in the home. And when my mother wasn't around, he started to physically abuse me. But there was one particular incident where I had kicked my younger brother, who was a delightful brother. I don't know why I had kicked him. I think my mother rued the day that she told my stepfather because he hit me and I went sprawling across and hit my eyebrow on the wall. I bled, it was painful. My mother was absolutely distraught because I think then was the revelation that actually he had been physically abusing me for some time, but I'd never told her. So she got in touch with my maternal grandparents in the northwest of England, and they rescued me.
It's obviously difficult to talk about those memories, still traumatic. How do you feel looking back, such a young girl and having to go through so much?
That was a very traumatic period of my life. Initially, I was quite angry with my mother. I was angry because I thought, why didn't she protect me? But as I grew older, I realised she was trying her best. She desperately wanted to make a home for me. But going to stay with my grandparents, it healed a lot of issues for me. It never took away the scar of that experience. But I think it showed me that there were good people around as well.
Elizabeth, it's time for your fourth disc. What are we going to hear?
Oh, this is the wonderful Andrea Bocelli singing A Te O Cara from Bellini's opera I Puritani. And it would just cheer me up immensely.
Te O Cara from Bellini's opera I Puritani, sung by Andrea Bocelli. So your love of opera came to you, Elizabeth Anionwu, during the happy time that you spent with your grandparents. Unfortunately, it was to be short-lived. Your grandfather died and later you went back to live with your mother, Ken, and their family. You'd always done well at school, despite the upheaval, and you finally began nurse training in 1965. That was at London's Paddington General Hospital. Do you remember putting on that uniform for the first time?
Oh, I certainly do. We were kitted out and had to wear these paper caps. Yes. You know, I felt I started my nursing journey by wearing the uniform, no doubt about it.
You later trained to be a midwife in Edinburgh and you became disillusioned with the hierarchical nature of the hospital and you decided to retrain as a health visitor. What was it that appealed to you about the job?
I didn't actually complete my midwifery course. I realised that I didn't cope well with institutions where there were rules and regulations that didn't make sense. When I discovered this profession called health visiting, you go into people's homes. And I knew then that you would have to earn the respect to get into people's homes. You're not on your own territory. But before I started the health visiting course, I had 9 months to spare and I decided to go and get a job in Paris with a wonderful medical family. And I was teaching English to their children. And I became friendly with a French Benin midwife who was quite active politically, I think. And I told her the story about washing my face 10 times to try and become white. She said, you know something? I know the very book that you should read, and it's called Black Skin, White Masks by Frantz Fanon. I read this book, and it really tried to explain about why people want to be white instead of black in terms of the impact of colonialism. And it was though the scales came off my eyes in terms of, look, I'm a brown-skinned person, and I don't know anything about my African heritage. When I came back to London, first thing I wanted to do was to get involved with black community activities, particularly health issues. And this was when I realised that there is this condition called sickle cell anemia. I'd met families then when I was a health visitor, and there were health inequalities in the sense that there wasn't as much information about this condition. The care could be much better. And I was now spurred up and decided this is an area that I would like to get involved with. But it was also helped by the fact that a haematologist called Dr. Misha Brozovic gave a couple of lectures. I asked a lot of questions, and after the second talk she came running after me, and cut a long story short, we ended up working together. And I became the first sickle cell nurse specialist in the UK back in 1979.
Elizabeth, let's take a break for some music. What are we going to hear, and why have you chosen this next disc?
So my next disc is Missa Bilban by the Jamaican folk singers. And I love folk music. And I heard this when I first went out to Jamaica in the late 70s to learn more about sickle cell.
Missa Bilban, how one party? In the no of the ruling. Come, we go buy a bunch of silver hair. If we go steal a young man, very bad. Oh, she make it buy, make it slimmer. Oh, she make it slimmer, make it buy. Oh, she make it buy, make it slimmer. Nancy, get your bunker right back, take a leg. 3 times 10 are 30. Yell a boy, them got 30. Sing me the tune of Bessie Van song. Make me dance Bessie Van and color.
The Jamaican folk singers with Missa Bilban. Elizabeth Annie Onwu, so we heard that after you became a health visitor, sickle cell became the focus of your life's work. Our understanding of sickle cell anemia is better now than it was back then, but many people still don't know much about it. Can you explain what it is?
It's an inherited disorder of the red blood cells, the hemoglobin inside the red blood cells. And if you have sickle cell anemia, you will have inherited it from both your parents, who generally do not have the illness. They are silent carriers. And it's characterised by mild to incredibly severe episodes of pain, susceptibility to infections, anemia as well. It can affect virtually every organ in the body.
What kind of understanding did people in general have of sickle cell disease back then?
Zilch. I have to say zilch. I mean, there would be paediatricians and blood specialists, haematologists who would have known about it. But I never had any lesson about it in my nurse training or my health visitor training. And this was starting to build up actually quite deep-seated anger in me.
So you were determined to change what was going on. I mean, how difficult a task were you facing?
The problem that brought people into hospital, this is children as well as adults, was what's called the painful crisis. And by the time they went to the accident and emergency unit, they were rolling around in pain. I mean, this is the most horrific pain that people can have. And most of these patients were young and black. And there would be, unfortunately, health professionals who thought they were drug addicts. Now, can you imagine?
And what about treatment? What was available for people?
It really depended which hospital you went to. And there were deaths that could have been avoided. And this is what encouraged some of us to form what is the Sickle Cell Society, a national charity, to enable families to come together with interested health professionals and others. And this actually did start to initiate change in policy.
You talked about the racism and the misunderstanding of the condition. Is that still a factor? Is that still out there?
When you consider the number of people who have the condition, it's at least 15,000 people. not enough resources are allocated if you compare it to a condition like cystic fibrosis. Now, cystic fibrosis is an extremely serious condition and needs all the resources that it's getting and probably more. But when we're talking about health inequalities, it's when you see disparities of that nature that you realise there's still some place to go to get conditions on an equal footing so that families do not feel that they're getting a lesser quality of care simply because of the colour of their skin.
It's time to take a break for some music, I think. What are we going to hear next and why have you chosen it?
It's Nina Simone. I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I love Nina Simone, both her voice, but also the life that she led. She was a gifted pianist who never made it to where she wanted to be, and she felt that that was due to racism. She was a feisty woman, and I just love her to bits, to be quite honest. And this is my favourite song of all that she has ever sung.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share.
Nina Simone and I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free. Elizabeth Anionwu, we've been talking about your professional life, but let's talk a bit more about your family. You had no knowledge of your father until 1972, and that was when you asked your mother for his name. Now, quite unexpectedly, you discovered that he was in London. So what was that first meeting like? Tell me about it.
Oh, it was fantastic. I used to ride a scooter in those days, and I had to go up the North Circular Road. And I remember parking the scooter, going up to the front door, and the nerves really kicked in. Pressed the doorbell, and he opened the door, and you know, Lauren, it was like mini-me. He was darker, he was male, he was larger than me. He just gave me this enormous bear hug, and he welcomed me. I met my stepmother. It was just wonderful.
What was he like?
Oh, he was very erudite. He was an ambassador before the Nigerian Civil War. Very educated, very dry sense of humour. And in fact, we discovered we had the same sense of humour and also the same love of music. That was wonderful. Mm. I never called him Dad initially. It was my stepmother who, after a few weeks, said, you know, he's your father. Call him Dad. Okay.
You were able to visit him in Nigeria later. How was it spending time with him there?
It was wonderful. And he just accepted me. I was his daughter, and he was obviously very proud of what I had achieved so far. I was very quiet initially, and at one point he said something that I didn't agree with, and I just burst out and said, oh. He said, oh, at last, he said, I knew you must have had some views. But it was me having to, you know, learn how to be a daughter, how to have that daughter-father relationship. And it worked out so well. I mean, unfortunately, you know, he died after 8 years, quite young. But I had a wonderful 8 years of knowing him and being introduced to my Nigerian family. It was like a balm. It soothed a lot of issues that I wasn't even aware of, and I became so much more confident and inwardly calmer, yes.
It's time for your next disc, Elizabeth. What have you chosen for us and why?
It's a song by an Igbo singer, Flavour, called Nekata. Now, my Igbo name that was given to me on my first visit to Nigeria is Neka, and it means my mother is supreme. And I thought that was wonderful for my family to appreciate everything that my mother had done, you know, when my father wasn't around. So this is why I've chosen the song, but also it's wonderful Nigerian singing.
Kilibe 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 no baby yo. Kilibe 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 no baby yo. Baby the sharp from head to toe. Baby, I like that crystal, oh baby, oh. Today na your day, kwado Bengali, oh. Mwa fichava, 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 no baby, oh. Nakata no didi, oh. Baby, more in the heart. So different, oh. Baby, more.
Flavor and Nekata. Elizabeth Anionwu, after your distinguished career, you were awarded a damehood in 2017 for your services to nursing and for your role in campaigning for a statue of the nurse Mary Seacole, the British Jamaican woman who treated British soldiers on the battlefield in the Crimean War at St Thomas's Hospital. I said in my introduction that the statue, which was unveiled just a few years ago, is the first statue of a named black woman in the UK. People might be shocked by that. Why is it important that she's there?
Well, you know, I must give recognition to Lord Clive Soley, who started the Mary Seacole Memorial Statue Appeal, and it took 12 and a half long, long years to raise the necessary money. Mary Seacole is part of the history of Britain. She was of Jamaican Scottish heritage, and the fact that she's brown-skinned should just not be important, but it is important. And the joy of having this wonderful, wonderful monument in the grounds of St Thomas's Hospital, overlooking the Houses of Parliament, and Mary is striding forth, and, you know, it's as though she's keeping an eye on those politicians. You know, it's wonderful from whatever background you are. But can you imagine how important it is for groups of individuals who don't always feel accepted? You know, I took my granddaughter down. She was there at the unveiling, but a few months later, she was staying with me and took her round, you know, London Eye. Round, and I said, is there anything else you want to see? Can we go and see Mary again? Oh, the joy in my heart. That's what it is about. My granddaughter can see a statue of a woman that looks like her in terms of skin colour. It's just wonderful.
You've talked a lot about your mother today, Elizabeth, and she died in 2003. I know that your sister Marion once told you that you'd led the life that your mum should have led. How did it feel hearing that?
Oh, what a poignant comment. It made me cry, actually, to be very honest, because I think my mother would have been a Professor Mary Beard, to be quite honest. She was so brilliant. As a woman, I, you know, regret that she didn't have the life she should have had. But on the other hand, she got succour and joy and comfort from her children.
And you're a mother yourself and a grandmother too. Having had such a disrupted early life and a tricky start, I wonder how that impacted your parenting. What kind of mother were you? Grandmother are you?
I was told by friends I was very over-anxious mum. But my daughter survived it, and we've got a very close relationship. And then to have the joy of a granddaughter, they both bring me great, great, great joy.
One more disc then before we cast you away to our desert island. What's it going to be, Elizabeth?
Well, it's the wonderful Otis Redding singing My Girl, but I think we should call it My Girls for my daughter and my granddaughter.
I've got the month of May. Oh, I guess you say, what can make you, me feel this way? It's my girl talking about my girl.
Otis Redding and My Girl. So it's time to cast you away to your desert island, Elizabeth Anionwu. Now, I'm assuming that your nursing experience will stand you in very good stead for life as a castaway.
Yes.
So we're going to give you three books to take with you. You'll have the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and a book of your choice too. What will that be?
It would be President Obama's memoirs, Dreams from My Father.
It's yours. You can also take a luxury item to make your stay on the island more enjoyable. What will that be?
I'd like a state-of-the-art trampoline. And the reason being, I have always wanted to jump on a trampoline. I think it's the inner child in me, and there's going to be nobody to see what I'm up to, and it'll be my physical exercise as well.
Fabulous. And finally, which one of your 8 wonderful discs would you save if the surf threatened to wash them all away?
Nina Simone, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
Professor Dame Elizabeth Anionwu, thank you so much for sharing your Desert Island Discs with us.
Thank you, Lauren. It's been wonderful.
Thinking of Elizabeth bouncing joyfully up and down on her trampoline really makes me very happy. I love doing that too. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. There are many of her fellow health professionals featured in the Desert Island Discs back catalogue, including ICU specialist Professor Hugh Montgomery, consultant anaesthetist Dr. Kevin Fong, consultant surgeon Dr. David Knott, and the neurosurgeon Henry Marsh. You'll find all those editions on BBC Sounds. Next time, my guest will be financial expert and campaigner Martin Lewis. I do hope you'll join us.
Hello, I'm Tim Harford, the presenter of More or Less. And I believe that if you want to understand the world, which is a very big, very complicated place, then numbers are an absolutely essential tool. They're like a telescope for an astronomer or an X-ray machine for a radiographer. Numbers answer questions we can't answer in any other way, such as, how safe is a home birth? And yes, we check the facts. What are those lying politicians lying to us about this week? So please subscribe to More or Less, and let numbers light up your world.